The FM Kicks Band presents summer big band concerts at Gooseberry Park in Moorhead on June 19th at 7 p.m., showcasing the sound of jazz for 50 years. Details at fmkicksband.com.
Welcome to this Monday here on Main Street on Prairie Public. We're happy that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we'll take a look back in history with the story of the Chautauqua movement in North Dakota. Barnes County Historical Society's Wes Anderson and Valley City native and historian Tim Burchell will tell us the history and what's coming Thursday night in a lecture that will be held in Valley City. And we begin Main Street today by welcoming a living legacy in American ministry and civil rights. Reverend Dr. Robert Polk is pastor, author, and trailblazer, and he joins us to reflect on a remarkable life of faith and service, from becoming Doane College's first black graduate in 1952 to leading churches in rural North Dakota during the early years of desegregation to ministering in one of New York's most influential pulpits. Reverend Polk has dedicated his life to bridging divides and building justice. And now at 97, he returns to North Dakota to be honored with a Trailblazer Award and to share the wisdom of his life's journey. Dr. Polk, welcome to Main Street.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be with you. And I go by Bob or Rev.
Also joining us today is longtime friend Lucille Loftus. Lucille, also welcome to Main Street. You're visiting with us today near Minot. Is that correct?
Yes.
And Dr. Polk is in Philadelphia on his way here soon. If I could begin with you, please. You were born in Chicago Southside in 1928 during the Great Migration. How did growing up in West Woodland shape your sense of identity and, I guess, your future calling?
Thanks for the question, Craig. In a major way, in that we lived in my community rather isolated. It was all black community, 99% black, and the communities around us were white. Chicago has always been considered to be one of the largest segregated cities in America. And so we had difficulty breaking through to, other than working, be with white people, except high school. We were mixed in high school. Elementary school was all black, except all white teachers. And I began to feel the urge and the need to widen my horizons and my experiences from my parents and five siblings and aunts and uncles and kids I grew up with. And it was through the church that I was able to go to conferences and weekend retreats and meet some very close people that became close friends of mine. So it all began to happen that way, Craig.
You were one of six children?
Yes, the youngest of six.
Tell me about your family.
It's a great family, not without our, you know, pros and cons, but mother and father came up, as you mentioned earlier, via the Great Migration, married in 1914, mother from Georgia, father from Texas, met in a church, Hardshell Baptist, and decided to set out to go to Woodlawn, where we lived, and raise a family. Three boys and three girls. We all had oodles of friends, and so our house was sort of the hub for people to come and dance and eat and visit, along with my aunts and uncles and my parents' church friends. We had a very riveting experience of always having people around us and with us. On a Sunday afternoon for dinner, there was always room for an extra person beyond the eight of us. Loving family, hardworking during the Depression as well as the Great Migration. So we were poor and had very little to eat sometimes, but we still sat around the table and ate and made ends meet. My dad worked very hard, and mother was a housekeeper and a manager of our house and people that came to room with us on the Great Migration.
I want to get to your later high school years and into college here in just a moment, but I want to bring you in, Lucille. How did you meet Bob? And as I understand it, you two haven't physically seen each other maybe in 60, 70 years. Is that right?
That's a long time ago.
That's right.
In 1947, I was a 13-year-old teenager who attended Pilgrim Park Camp, a Bible camp at Lake Minnetonka near Botno, North Dakota. And Bob came to that camp for the summer because he was the national secretary of the Pilgrim Fellowship of the Congregational Church. I never saw him again until I learned of today.
We're visiting via the beauty of technology. We all get to see one another, and it's just wonderful. Yeah. Lucille, you're part of a group that's organizing really some special recognition here in Minot for Dr. Polk. Tell me about what you have planned.
We're calling it a Bob party, and we want it to be just that, a celebration of him being able to return to North Dakota after that many years. And it just happens that when I learned about his book by walking out of Main Street Books in Minot, I made a connection with both another person who was a camper, Betty Wheeler, and a publisher of the book helped me find a number to talk to Bob. And then it was only last summer that we said, we have to have this Bob party.
What are you going to do at the Bob party?
We have several things planned. So when he comes in Thursday night, he'll have his stay at the Staybridge Inn in Minot. And then Friday, we're starting out early in the morning. So I hope he's up to it by going to the Minot Air Force Base, which we know he had a lot to do with in 1955, maybe, or in those years when the base came into being. And then we have a book signing and a meet and greet at the inn where he's staying Friday evening. Saturday, the ceremony that will take place for giving him some awards. We have a banquet following that. And going into Sunday, he'll have an event in Garrison, which that church was one that he served. And they will be celebrating their 120th anniversary, along with Bob's 70th anniversary of his ordination. Monday, there are four service clubs in Minot, and those groups will hope to welcome him at the Sleep Inn in Minot for a luncheon.
Bob, are you going to preach in Garrison?
Yes, I plan to. I was asked to anyway.
What are you going
to
talk about?
I'm going to talk about one of my favorite passages, Craig, from John 17. That they all may be one. Since my ministry has been built around being the best pastor I can be, number one, and combining that or coupling that with social justice and race relations. And that's the core of what the sermon is all about. But secondarily, and so more importantly, it's also the logo of my denomination, the United Church of Christ. When you see the United Church of Christ symbol, you see a cross, an orb, and underneath it says that they all may be one. And that's what I'm going to be speaking about, trying to infuse the fact that we're still so divided, even more so today, in terms of race, class, culture, opportunities, that's what Jesus asked that we become as his disciples. That's going to be my takeoff. And that's what I've been doing for 70 years.
Taking back to your latter high school days, you're a junior now, you're a senior now, and you were really thinking about what you wanted to do for the rest of your life. You ended up at Doane College. And that wasn't easy to have happen. Bob, tell us what happened.
Well, first of all, I didn't think about what I was going to do the rest of my life because the war was on, Second World War, and all the men of my class were subject to being called to the service the day after graduation. But then the war ended before we graduated, and we were left hanging, didn't know what our plans were because we were going to become military people, army people. And I went to community college first, junior college. And at that point, I began to think with the help of my minister and his wife and Pilgrim Fellowship that Lucille has talked about, doing something more creative with my life. And then I decided after community college that I could handle it. I would work a year, earn enough money to go to little college that I had attended for a national meeting in 1946, Doane College in Nebraska. And one of the young ladies from my church and I applied. She was encouraged by me. And the college dean of the students turned us down because we were Black. And they wouldn't let us in unless we had Black roommates. Interestingly enough, I should have said Black male roommates or Black female roommates. But anyway, and I was very disturbed. I was working for the denomination at that time in their Pilgrim Press bookstore, 19 South LaSalle, Chicago. And I took the letter and showed it to some of the hierarchical clergy from the denomination. And in about 4 weeks' time, we had a second letter saying we had been accepted. There was a new dean of students. They gave us the names of who our roommates would be, and that was the initiating letter that said that we could come to Doane College, and we both went and had very fine experiences.
Tell me how this formal theological training then shaped your future. And I want to know then, how did you end up in North Dakota?
Well, formal education, my minister and his wife went to Hartford Seminary, and you know, you sort of follow in the footsteps of your mentors and some of the other people that I knew in the denomination in Chicago also were Hartford graduates. And they said Hartford was the place to train clergy to be pastors, not the theologians or scholars, et cetera, which Yale and Chicago Theological Seminary and other schools were. So I decided I was equipped to do something like that once I decided to accept the call into the ministry. So I went to this wonderful school, Hartford Theological Seminary, and a great class of fellow students, men and women. And that was the beginning of the reassurance that that's what I wanted to devote my life to. And when I was there and before I was there, I was very much involved with Pilgrim Fellowship and social action, political action, and personal action. So taking sort of body, mind, and spirit and using that triangle to go out and do something on behalf of other people, serving people, the poor, the hungry, the disenfranchised, the disinherited, and especially in my own Black self, in my own Black community. That's how I got started. And when I graduated, I didn't have a job in the denomination, but I had been to North Dakota to do a summer ministry in the city of town of Garrison. So I asked what we would normally call the bishop to, if he had a job for me. He said, well, you know, there are no Black people in North Dakota. There's no Black churches. He said, but if I would find you, if I could find you a job, would you come? He put me on the spot. Well, the Spirit said to me, say yes. I said yes. And he found this wonderful little tiny rural town called Berthold, about 400 souls, no running water, no paved streets, no lamps in the streets. And, you know, there I was thrown into the wilds of the Great Prairie. And having heard a lot of radio stories about that part of the world, I thought, boy, I've arrived, except when it came to indoor facilities. I had to go out to the outhouse, and that didn't sit very well with me. That's a different story.
We are enjoying our conversation with Dr. Robert L. Polk. He's a trailblazing civil rights era clergyman, author, and educator whose life of service has spanned over 7 decades. He will be in North Dakota in the Minot area beginning Friday, June 20th. Is that correct, Lucille?
Correct. And, yes, he's arriving on the 19th.
On the 19th, on Thursday. And then he will be, of course, doing the events that Lucille talked about. Bob, it's reported that you were the 48th Black person in the state of North Dakota, and you came to a place where you were the only Black person in your church.
Yes.
How did that impact you for the rest of your life?
Craig, people cannot wrap their minds around that part of this exceptional story. They think something went wrong. My Black community and my family and my roots, they said, man, you are crazy, you know, going to an all-white state, you know, and you're the only 48th Black person in the entire state. And then the white community said, why is he here? You know, what? And they didn't know Black people. These great Scandinavians, Loftusness, and all the great names, and Norwegians, and Danes, and Swedes, and Germans. They were busy trying to, you know, put their farms together. They worked hard. The most wonderful book I ever read about them before I even thought about going there is called Giants and the Earth. The book by Rovick talks about what it was like to break open that part of the country, the prairies, for farmers who had been given the property if they could hold on to it. And so it was like trying to bring the gospel to these people. Most of them had more of the gospel than I did, and also trying to fit in areas of social justice where it was acceptable to people who were basically, you know, white Republicans. So being the 48th person, I didn't see another Black person, and so I looked in the mirror for weeks and months on edge. And everybody thought I was crazy. My family thought I was nuts, and white folks thought, why is he here? But I did believe theologically and biblically that there was a place for me, that wonderful song from West Side Story. There is a place for me to in a sense, not peddle, but to share who I was as a person, as a Black person, and help the non-unprejudiced white people to take a second look at what it means to be a part of the beloved community.
Lucille, when you went to camp and you saw Dr. Polk, a Black person being part of the leadership of the camp folks who were with you, what was going through your mind?
Well, if I can remember correctly, it just seems to me that this teenager, I looked at him as a teenager too. He had his jeans on and his casual shirt, and I just thought he's one of us. I don't think I ever thought otherwise.
Where did you go from North Dakota, Dr. Polk?
Well, I had the good fortune, Craig, from leaving my wonderful job with at the YMCA in Minot, working with the teenagers, about 400, 300, 50 teenagers, junior and senior high school kids, to the Riverside Church in the city of New York, a great big bastion on the Hudson River built by John D. Rockefeller Jr. as an interracial, interdenominational, and international church. And they had a burgeoning youth program, like I did at the Y, but theirs was totally multicultural. Asians, African-Americans, Hispanics, and whites in different classes. They were looking for someone to harness the energy of those 350 kids, Sunday school on Sunday mornings, and a great youth program on Friday nights. And I was one of five candidates for that job. And I will say this when I get to the events in Minot next week. You know, I think it was because of my work at the YMCA and Berthold and Garrison that I was the one that was accepted for the job, because I was Black, but I had worked with white people without any difficulties, and we loved each other. And therefore, they thought I could probably balance the multicultural side of this, as well as the kids in Sunday school and develop workers and advisors. And I will use this term next week. I will say to them, because of you, meaning those with whom I worked in North Dakota, I went on to become, to do some very interesting and exciting things in my life.
You had challenges and opportunities to discuss civil rights issues, to work with in a prison ministry, to do work relative to HIV/AIDS. Tell us about some of those challenges, Dr. Polk.
Well, the great Dr. Howard Thurman, who was a great Black theologian, preacher, scholar, and mystic, he has a great book out, which he's of the last century, called Jesus and the Disinherited. I came out of being a disinherited person personally from being Black and poor during the Depression. And I guess God wanted me to do this work and gave me the kind of sensitivity and appreciation for all of his people and for all of his creation. And I think it just began to, I won't say snowball, but it began to grow on me, saying, this is what you are to do. And therefore, when the AIDS issue came along, I organized the first AIDS program in New York City. Others began to follow, and then the government gave us money, but it cost me my job because I used so much money to develop that program. Incarceration, the largest number of incarcerated people in America happen to be Black and brown, and some of them need not be there, but they didn't have money for bail or attorneys, counsel, et cetera. And so my church allowed me to develop a pastoral ministry to the, we call it, forget the name of it, jail ministry, prison ministry, we called it. And I had the freedom at that church because I didn't need any money. Everything I wanted to do was basically funded at a wonderful committee to do those kind of things that other churches didn't start for another decade or so. So I was so blessed to be at that church. And it was snooty. You know, there were people that still came to church in limousines. When King would speak there, Dr. King, they would have their servants with them, et cetera. But that began to taper off and it became more of a community church. And I was also a part of that part of the church developing. So all of those things are sort of in my DNA, Craig. And it's been just what I prayed for when I put my hand on the Bible and people put their hands on me to say, you are one of God's children to be a pastor.
Lucille, tell me more about your committee's work. What have you been working on relative to this trip?
Well, we started out with an invitation list, and we invited Bob to provide that to us because we knew that his friends reached worldwide. His acquaintances were more than we could fathom. Every time I typed an address, it was from another state, and I almost think I might have typed every state in the U.S. as I was sending out what we sent as invitations. And from then on, we've been hearing from folks, but I have to say it's been sad because we've learned that many of the people are his age and my age, and we aren't expecting them. But we do know that we will hear from some of them that are able to do that, and that's encouraging. We have descendants. I'm talking to the fourth generation this morning when she called to register for the banquet. And I know that, Bob, can I say the name of Walter Troxell?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, well, that was of that family.
I'll be there.
And he was a senator in the North Dakota legislature at the time that Bob was serving his church. And we have a man who was his great-grandson coming to the celebration.
How wonderful, yes.
Lucille, what's the Trailblazer Award?
We are, we call it notable. Mm-hmm. Notable experiences that Bob had in the state of North Dakota. And that's what we are enumerating for giving him all the thanks that we possibly can.
Bob, when you visit with the folks in Garrison and in Minot and all of the different places that you're going to be here beginning this coming Thursday, and you also consider everything that's happening in our world today, do you have hope?
I must say, Craig, that's a catchy question, and my hope is marginal. Everything that's happening today, I don't have a great deal of hope in my heart and in my life. Friends of mine will say, well, we've had bad times before, during the McCarthy era, during slavery, during emancipation, during all civil rights movement, during the George Floyd movement, during all these things. And we found a way out of them, thank God. But I'm not sure that I have a great deal of hope in terms of how this is going to end. And I say sort of flippantly to myself, well, I'm too old to be around when it's going to take place. So I'm not sure what's going to happen to it. And I'm going to sort of steer clear of that because it's a toxic issue. We are a divided nation in four or five ways, looking at what's happened in Los Angeles this week and in the past, George Floyd, and during my era, the civil rights program. And, it's hard to reconcile and have a sense of wholeness in this creation that God created for us in terms of that issue. But you see, God created all the things that we have been able to share, and we've certainly messed them up. So my hope is limited, but it's not completely despairing. That was a loaded question.
It was, but I so appreciate your answer. Let's all have hope, shall we?
Sure. Mm-hmm. One of the exciting parts about coming back over and above seeing my old friends, old haunts, is the fact that, we believe this should be a part of the history of the state of North Dakota. It's been sort of tucked away. It was done back in 1955 to 1960. And so here's God's chance to say, this should be in the books, part of the canon of the state of North Dakota. But most people don't know about it. So what Lucille and her wonderful committee have been doing is helping us to do that part of it also, so it doesn't get lost.
My guest has been Dr. Robert Polk. He'll be in the Minot area beginning Thursday, and he'll be honored in many, many ways by the group that Lucille Loftusness has worked with in Minot. It's a pleasure to visit with you, Dr. Polk, and I want to thank you and wish you the best. You are 97 years old.
97, exactly.
And Lucille, thank you for doing the work that you're doing and for reaching out to Dr. Polk. I think it'll be a wonderful celebration, and it's been a pleasure visiting with you.
Thank you for allowing me to see Lucille before I arrive.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to be on. Thank you, Craig, and yes, to Merrill Pepcorn as well, who helped me get this started.
Yeah, I really appreciate that Merrill reached out to us. Thank you both for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. It's been a pleasure.
I appreciate it also.
Still to come on Main Street, a Thursday night history lecture in Valley City about the early 1900s Chautauqua movement in North Dakota. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, announcing the 2025 Bush Fellows. Meet the leaders thinking bigger and differently about what's possible for their communities in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. More information at bushfoundation.org.
Main Street continues on this Monday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and the Barnes County Historical Society Lecture Series will come again this week. It's at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, June 19th at the Barnes County Museum. The talk is about the Chautauqua movement in North Dakota. And joining me to discuss is Tim Burchell. He's the main presenter, and Wes Anderson from the Barnes County Historical Society. Both to Tim and Wes, welcome to Main Street.
Good morning.
How are you?
We're doing well today. We're glad that you're with us, Tim. And I'm going to start with Wes first. Just give me a background about the lecture series and what you hope to accomplish and how the idea came forward, Wes.
Well, let's see. This is something that started back 1999. So it's our 24th year because we had to take a year off for COVID. So we got interrupted on it. But we have a monthly lecture series that starts out August, September, and runs through June with our annual meeting conclusion. And so that's what this is. And we talk a lot of, random topics. There's history, there's geography, there's some science, there's some political, there's a lot of different topics get covered. And it's just a neat offering to be able to offer our members, our visitors. It's open to all, it's free. It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 19th.
So, Tim, you're the main presenter. Again, the topic is the Chautauqua movement in North Dakota. Give us a background on what Chautauqua is or was, I guess. It has its roots clear back to the late 1800s?
Yeah, actually, I think it originated in the 1870s. And it was a way to, among other things, to bring, culture and education to people, particularly in rural areas. It originated in upstate New York, and actually the original idea came from a Methodist minister who had decided that maybe he would try educating Sunday school teachers in an outdoor, kind of a natural, beautiful setting, and that might be effective, an effective method for doing that, and it kind of blossomed into a way to bring many topics to in effect the general public.
What made North Dakota and especially Barnes County a fertile ground then for Chautauqua culture?
That's a good question. I grew up in Barnes County. I know Valley City had, has always had the college, which was originally a teacher's normal school, they called it. But always had kind of an intellectual community or kind of a core that lived in the Valley City area. And I think that the enthusiasm was what was there was fertile ground. But it came later to Valley City. The first Chautauqua gathering in North Dakota was in the early 1890s. And Valley City started its Chautauqua program in 1910. So, I have no idea why, why that gap in years, because there was a regional, I guess you'd call it, Chautauqua program started at Devil's Lake, where there were buildings built and a whole complex was constructed surrounding an annual Chautauqua gathering.
What would we see, Tim, at a Chautauqua gathering?
Oh, it's for the whole family, men, women, and children. People would come, specifically speaking of the Devil's Lake and the Valley City Chautauquas, that families would come for it went for a whole 2 weeks. Families would come and camp. They'd bring their tents just set up basically residence on the ground. And there would be programs that would last basically from morning to night. They'd eat all three meals on the ground. The cost of attending Chautauqua was pretty low, but then they could purchase meals and they could rent camping equipment and all that sort of thing. And it was cultural. The programs were cultural. I mean, such as drama, poetry, music, you know, many other things that normally rural folks wouldn't have access to really see. National speakers, including former President Taft, William Jennings Bryan, some of the biggest names of the day, made the Chautauqua circuit. Also included was recreational time, swimming, games, and for the young people and for the adults who wanted to take part. The Barnes County Chautauqua also had a kind of a camp for girls and a camp for boys, an encampment that was very much military kind of in orientation, where, you know, that there would be educational sessions for the youth throughout the day. And I guess it was a means of learning, you know, self-discipline order and organization and being educated at the same time.
It was also affiliated with the scouting program. So North Dakota started its scouting program, I think about 1910, 1911, and they had a early meeting out at Valley City Chautauqua. There's a marker out there for that.
I didn't know that, Wes. Thank you.
I understand in some research that I've done that at Devil's Lake, Chautauqua featured special attractions, even like airplane demonstrations and steamships. Mm-hmm. Give us more about that. Right.
Well, there was a steamship on Devil's Lake called the Mini H. It was owned by Ed Heerman, H-E-E-R-M-A-N, and he went by Captain. We didn't have too many, you know, naval captains in North Dakota, but Devil's Lake was a large body of water, and people would go on excursions from one end of the lake to another, because it was something so different, I guess, for people from our inland rural state, so far from any kind of big water. And of course, we know that 1910, I mean, airplanes were a novelty, and I'm sure it was a thrill just to see an airplane fly over, much less to see daredevil pilots doing stunts in the air. It would have been something that people would marvel at and remember and tell all their friends about.
Do we have a feel for how many people came to both Devil's Lake Chautauqua events and Valley City Chautauqua events?
Wes, can you venture a guess?
Hundreds.
Yeah. I think in Devil's Lake, that was the big one for the state of North Dakota, 400 or 500. And it wouldn't be the same people the whole time either. Some people came for a day or two, and then they had to go home, and you know, there were things to do on the farm that had to be done. And some people came and stayed the whole two weeks, and were able to take that time, and as sort of a family vacation. And it would be held kind of at a break in the summertime, when between spring planting and harvest time, sort of, there was a, you know, I remember growing up on the farm too, there was kind of a lull there the first end of June, first couple of weeks of July, and that's when the gathering in Valley City seemed to always take place.
Usually involved a big tent, and was at Valley City had built a pavilion in 1914, and so that was a very, very large building out there in Chautauqua Park, and then it got moved about after World War II and became the North Dakota Winter Show Pavilion for Valley City until they built the current one up on the hill.
Mm-hmm. We're enjoying our conversation with Wes Anderson. He leads the Barnes County Historical Society, and also Tim Burchell. Tim was born in Valley City and was raised on a farm in the northeast corner of Barnes County near Pillsbury. He's attended Valley City State College and graduated from Concordia College and had a degree in hospital administration and is recently retired. And Tim, as I understand, you have a massive collection of North Dakota history, several thousand books and maps and other materials that pertain to our state. give our listeners a sense of why North Dakota's history has become so important to you.
I was, as a kid, I was totally obsessed with all things North Dakota. And I was always so proud. You know, we're the few, the proud, you know, the North Dakotans. And I was always, you know, very, very proud. That isn't even a strong enough word to be a North Dakotan. And so, and also I was interested in history from as long as I can remember. So I started a collection when I was probably 10 years old and had a shelf full of North Dakota related publications. So that kind of blossomed and over the years, and now I'm in my 60s and I'm sitting surrounded by 17 bookcases and closets full of North Dakota resources, books, maps, pamphlets, booklets, you name it. And yeah, it's kind of taken over my house, and my wife reminds me that it dominates our house quite often. But I've enjoyed collecting, and I've enjoyed learning more and more about the state. Have to say, though, I have to bow to Wes as the professional. I have to bow to his superior body of knowledge. This has been his life, and it's been just an avocation, a hobby for me, and something that's brought me a lot of joy. Our local museum over here in Stutzman County has, in the summertime, they have a series called the Front Porch Chats on every Sunday afternoon. And so the people in charge of that got a hold of me about 15 years ago. And so I've been hooked doing a couple of these lectures over here every summer. And this is one that I've done in Jamestown that, you know, really I'm looking forward to doing in Valley City, because this is kind of, that's where a lot of this happened, you know, my home county, my home county seat. Yeah, and my mother and much of my family still live in Valley, so I'm looking forward to being there this week.
And the lecture that Tim will give is the Chautauqua Movement in North Dakota. It's at 7:30 p.m. Thursday, June 19th at the Barnes County Museum. Wes, is there any admission charge, or how does the process work if you want to come and enjoy Tim's lecture?
It is free. And like I said, this is our conclusion of season 24. So our society annual meeting is at 7:00. And in there is reports of activities and how our finances are doing, and election of a couple board members to the board to replace a couple that have gone off. And then the official lecture for Tim is at 7:30. And it's free. It's open to the public. Show up. Come on in. And enjoy it. It is always an enjoyable evening. I just happened to find a poster here a number of years ago. I did a lecture on the theaters of Valley City, and of course one of them was the Chautauqua Pavilion, and I found the advertisements. And so I don't have the year on this one, but it says, nestled in the valley of the Cheyenne River, surrounded by hill, forest, and groves, a beautiful spot for the Valley City Chautauqua Assembly. There will be 10 days program with 3 high-class entertainments each day. Talent, oratorical, entertainment, musical. Great care has been taken to select and engage the best talent available. Governor Burke, Honorable W.J. Bryan, and other prominent men will speak. William McCormick, a student of nature and a bird warbler with his Scotch Collie, will appear on Children's Day, July 8th. The Metropolitan Ladies Orchestra will give a series of concerts the first 4 days. Madam Florence Sage and her quartet will be heard. Baseball every day except Sunday. Boy Scouts, 9 patrols from Valley City and patrols from many of the surrounding cities with their scout masters will be camping on the grounds during the entire sessions. For information regarding tents, boats, camping, address F.E. Osborne, Secretary of Valley City. And this is through the Northern Pacific is advertising this. So it was a big deal, and it continued here through 1932, the last official year of Chautauqua. In fact, we had a reconstruction of Chautauqua back in 2004 with the North Dakota Humanities Council. They had long traveled the region with their tent, and they came back to Valley City in 2004 as the conclusion of their series. They didn't do it after that, but brought the huge blue and white tent, and there was a a raising ceremony for people that came out there and helped us put up the tent. And we had a meal out there and a beginning evening. And then for 3 or 4 days that we had speakers every day out there. And good recreation of Chautauqua.
We know what led to the end, either Tim or Wes, of the Chautauqua movement. Was it the Depression that factored into this?
Depression, radio, I suppose.
That brought some of this entertainment to people's living rooms?
I would say it was probably, Wes is right. The economy was kind of collapsing around 1930 due to drought and depression, and the monies weren't there, I guess, to fund, the traveling events that were going on. Plus, radio came around in the 20s, and then television not too many years after that. So it kind of that kind of took the place of, having to gather in person in one location to experience these kinds of opportunities. I think one thing that I failed to mention was Theodore Roosevelt once was quoted as saying that Chautauqua is the most American thing in America. And it was not a shameful thing to be labeled as a progressive back then. Right now, some people think that's kind of a bad word, but people wanted to learn. They thirsted for knowledge. They wanted to better themselves, and they believed we could build a better society by getting to know each other, by being educated, and becoming knowledgeable about a lot of different topics. And we kind of lost that in a way. I think that Chautauqua was a wonderful thing for its day.
Tim, in my eyes, and Wes too, this was kind of like a large county fair-like event. Is that an accurate comparison?
I wouldn't think so. No, the women all wore white. So that was a thing. And I'm looking at some pictures from that era, and it says Chautauqua program Wednesday, July 12th, 9 a.m. Boy Scouts Bible class conducted by Reverend J.M. Walters of the First Methodist Church of Fargo. Let's see, CLSC roundtable 10 a.m. WCTU Women's Christian Temperance Union Institute, the use of alcohol as a remedy, home loyalty, Boy Scouts 11 o'clock, male quartet, prelude to Clarence Bergendorfer, entertainer of various costumes, children's hour, 12 o'clock noon, picnic, 2 o'clock, chorus class, 3 o'clock, male quartet, prelude to Governor Burke, Miss Jeanette Diedrich, soloist of the Valley City Normal School, 6:15, baseball, 8 o'clock, male quartet, prelude to C.H. Plattenberg, Worms Beneath the Bark, Professor Knut Freusia of the Valley City Normal School, and 9:30, moving pictures. So... It had nothing to do with business, had nothing to do with anything commercial. It was pure education and entertainment, edutainment, I suppose. But
with a religious focus, it seems to me.
Yeah,
it was in definitely. There. Yeah, very much Protestant, and yeah. So
yeah, I think that I think Wes is right. I think that Barnes County did have a fair back then. I think when the winter show came along, the county fair ceased to happen anymore. But it was very much more of an educational focus. Now, it was no doubt a big economic boost for Valley City, just like any large event of that type would be. And in the Chautauqua brochures and booklets advertising the program, there were all sorts of ads from different businesses. Come and get your camping equipment at so-and-so hardware store, and, all the finest foods at blah, blah grocery. And, I'm sure it had a huge economic impact on the town.
Oh, definitely.
Well, gentlemen, I'll wind up our conversation. It's been a pleasure to have you both. My guest has been Tim Burchell. He's presenting a lecture, The Chautauqua Movement in North Dakota, and that will start at 7:30 p.m. following the 7 p.m. meeting of the Barnes County Historical Society. and that's on Thursday, June 19th. It all happens at the Barnes County Museum. Also with us today is Wes Anderson, our good friend. Wes, it's great to have you back on the show. You're always certainly welcome here. You're so interesting to visit with, as Tim kind of alluded to, and he is the leader of the Barnes County Historical Society. So, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you so much for being interested in this and for having us.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 16th. The Roman Catholic Church's presence in North Dakota dates back to territorial days. In 1910, Pope Pius X created the Diocese of Bismarck, calling a new bishop to serve the diocese. Wherley, previously abbot of Assumption Abbey in Richardton, was selected and installed by the Most Reverend John Ireland, Archbishop of St. Paul. Wherley chose St. Mary's to be the provisional cathedral, or pro-cathedral, of the new diocese. Thousands gathered in the city with special trains bringing visitors from across the state to the capital for the grand event. Governor Burke, several clergymen and dignitaries from Bismarck and surrounding communities all took part in the festivities. A parade more than a mile long marched from the Northern Pacific Depot through downtown to St. Mary's. It featured the Bismarck Band, members of the Grand Army of the Republic, brothers from the Abbey, and several community and religious organizations. Archbishop Ireland praised Bismarck's new episcopal role, and the Tribune noted that the event would long be remembered in the history of Western North Dakota. A potential high mass was celebrated for the installation. St. Mary's was resplendent with flowers and adornments for the occasion. After reading papal bulls and declaring the new diocese properly formed and erected, with Bismarck as the See City, Ireland led Wherley to the altar and bestowed upon him his vestments and mitre. He then escorted Wherley to the episcopal throne, where the clergy paid homage by kneeling and kissing the new bishop's ring. Bishop Wherley oversaw tremendous growth in the diocese, with many new parishes and congregations forming. He helped establish 18 parochial schools and nearly doubled the Catholic population in the region. He served as Bishop of Bismarck until December 11, 1939, when he resigned due to health reasons. He died in Bismarck on November 2, 1941, and is buried in Assumption Abbey's crypt. Bishop Wherley's legacy lives on in the Cathedral of the Holy Spirit in West Bismarck, which he began constructing. In addition, St. Mary's retains its link to that important role by keeping the pro-cathedral in its name. It will celebrate 150 years in 2027. Bismarck's Catholic community has much to be proud of, and their first bishop, Vincent Wherley, stands as a testament to their enduring faith and impact on the religious and historical landscape of the region. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Daniel Sauerwein. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Myron Sommerfeld and his band present the third annual Peggy Lee Day. You can join the celebration with a 7 p.m. screening of the 1969 PBS documentary Net Presents Miss Peggy Lee at the Larry J. Robinson Center for the Arts on the Valley City State University campus. A coffee and ice cream social follows. All are welcome to attend.
And that wraps up this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the show. Tomorrow on Main Street, we'll preview Night Bazaar. Renaissance returns to downtown Fargo. That's upcoming on Wednesday, June 26th. It's from 5 to 10 p.m. Broadway Square will transform into a magical medieval carnival with live music, sword fighting, artist markets, delicious food, and royal revelry. You can dress up and bring the family and unlock the magic, and we'll have all of that previewed tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, from all of us at Prairie Public, we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.